Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. Even the latest mass shooting, this time done by a lone white male with an assault rifle, imagine that, can't eclipse the atrocity now being inflicted by Israel and the United States on Gaza. Nearly 2 weeks ago, hundreds or perhaps over 1,000 Hamas fighters staged a large raid into Israeli-occupied areas, targeting and killing any Israelis they could find, mostly civilians. It was a brutal act of terrorism, and nearly everyone rightly condemns it, but we mustn't lose sight of the context in which this has happened, namely that Israel's new far-right government has accelerated its attacks on Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, building more settlements, demolishing more Palestinian homes, and rationing goods and resources more harshly. Gaza was already like a huge concentration camp in some regards, others describe it as an outdoor prison. It's one of the most densely populated concentrations on the planet, with a majority of its residents being refugees from other parts of Palestine who were forcibly evicted by Israel illegally as Israel annexed more and more land. That has been going on since 1967. All Israeli territory beyond the 67 borders is unlawfully occupied, yet the United States funds the Israeli government to the tune of billions of dollars every year, without ever once threatening to make the aid conditional on Israel's compliance with international law. Palestinians were desperate, and Hamas the equivalent of desperados. Hamas was elected once, nearly 20 years ago, replacing the former government of Fatah, which many Palestinians regarded as simply too weak or as appeasing toward Israel. But Hamas has not held elections since, and its guerrilla tactics of resistance to the Israeli occupation have evolved into a low-grade campaign of terrorism. If they can't beat the occupiers, at least they make the Israelis uncomfortable. The latest Hamas attack was on a whole different scale, however, and has produced the predictably disproportionate response from Israel, which has been bombing civilian targets in Gaza ever since, killing nearly four times as many Gazans as the number of Israelis killed by Hamas. Many of the Gazan dead are children. Protests have been held around the world calling upon Israel to broker a ceasefire. The Biden administration, however, has called ceasefire advocacy reprehensible. Israel has not yet succeeded in rooting out Hamas, but its callous disregard for non-combatants, also referred to as civilians, has been fully evident to anyone paying the slightest attention. Israel has targeted hospitals, schools, and vital infrastructure, and even convoys of refugees fleeing to the south. International human rights agencies and Secretary General of the United Nations and numerous governments have accused Israel of war crimes. But as long as the U.S. remains steadfast in its support, Israel seems as impervious to world opinion as it is defiant of international law. Israel's president has justified the targeting of civilians in Gaza, saying that Gazans are all responsible, or as some has translated it, that there are no innocents there. Israel's defense minister has referred to Palestinians as animals who will be treated as such. But if there were a population of wild animals that occasionally attacked people in the U.S., say like wolves or bears or sharks, and the government were to engage in a campaign to completely eradicate them, there would be public outcry here. Even wolves in the U.S. have more legal protection than Palestinians. And as Gaza's hospitals go dark for want of electricity, because Israel will not permit the importation of fuel to run generators, with Palestinian babies in incubators may die. And I say that not to be melodramatic, but to point out the sheer hypocrisy of what my friend Ora Wise, who co-founded a Palestinian solidarity group here in Columbus many years ago, called selective compassion. The U.S. assault on Iraq was excused by a false report of babies in incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital being killed by Iraqi soldiers. That never happened at all. It was exposed as a complete fabrication. But now that real babies and injured children and adults are actually dying for lack of medical care as a direct result of the U.S. approved and funded bombing of civilians by Israel, where's the outcry? Where's the indignation? Where are the calls for a ceasefire? And where are the armchair critics who scolded the Black Lives Matter movement with taunts of all lives matter now? But hypocrisy, it seems, is as American as apple pie, and it runs especially deep when it comes to the lawless apartheid state of Israel. People like to echo the mantra that Israel has the right to defend itself, but this assault on Gaza is indefensible, as is the whole occupation. In today's show, we'll hear from Professor Ian Popp, a noted critic of Israeli policies and who is also an Israeli historian who now teaches in London. This talk was recorded just last week.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Usama Maqdisi, and I'm the Chancellor's Chair and Professor in the Department of History here at UC Berkeley. Before I introduce our speaker and the event this evening, I was asked to read the statement by the law school where we're currently convening. The law school says, quote, "Free speech and academic freedom are foundational values for the University of California. UC Berkeley is committed to the belief that speech we may not like or agree with should be confronted with respectful speech rather than censorship. UC Berkeley's principles of community call for civility and respect in our personal interactions. If you would like to express a point of view that is different from what our guests present this evening, you may do so in any area of campus that is open to public free speech. You, of course, may ask questions at the appropriate time, and you'll have the notes that will be distributed. You are at the appropriate time. However, you are not permitted to disrupt this event. We ask you, as audience members, to be respectful of the speakers and the students in attendance and refrain from any disruptive behavior. If you attempt to disrupt this event, you will be asked to leave the venue and face possible student disciplinary action." So, end quote. On the less disciplinary note, I want to acknowledge all the sponsors of this lecture. At UC Berkeley, they are the Law Students for Justice in Palestine, the Department of History, the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, the Department of Ethnic Studies, the Islamophobia Research and Documentation Project of the Center for Race and Gender. I also need to acknowledge the assistance of Norkel Sabil, Dr. Hatem Bazian, as well as the indispensable help of Mr. Hassan Fouda. I realize, of course, that we're gathered here in extraordinary circumstances, given the ongoing, inhumane brutalization of Gaza. I realize as well that there's a lot of pain and anger in this room. Many of you, like me, are suffering. Many have friends in Palestine and Israel, and some of you have lost friends or family because of the ongoing situation. Many of you are angry, as I am, at an evident double standard we see everywhere in this country, at the devaluation of Palestinian humanity and history, including by members in this institution. Many of you are suffering intimidation, especially the students here, for standing up for justice and equality in Palestine. I hope, however, you will draw some little hope from the fact that we are hosting a figure as distinguished as Professor Ilan Pape. Distinguished and at the same time down to earth. There are very few figures who are as august and as intelligent and as brilliant as Ilan and at the same time as down to earth. I say this because Ilan is not only a brilliant historian and colleague, he's also a wonderful person whose presence here is much needed to provide crucial context to help us make sense of what is going on in Israel and, of course, in occupied Palestine. Professor Ilan Pape is the director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK, and the first such center, as far as I'm aware, anywhere in Europe, and in fact, anywhere in Europe or the United States. He received his DPhil, that's English for PhD, from the University of Oxford in 1984, where he worked under the supervision of Professor Albert Horani. Until 2007, Ilan was a professor at the University of Haifa, from which he was expelled due to his ideological positions. In other words, he actually insisted on unearthing and supporting research about the Nakba of 1948. He moved to Exeter, where he teaches now at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies. Professor Pape has written 20 books to date, the most famous of which, without any doubt, is his 2006, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which drew, of course, the ire of many in the political establishment and many in the academic establishment, because Ilan was one of the first, in English at least, and from an Israeli perspective, a dissident perspective, to put the question of ethnic cleansing straight up there. So in a way that was sort of difficult to deny. He's also the author of The Biggest Prison on Earth, A History of the Israeli Occupation. His most recent book is co-edited with Remzi Baroud, and it's entitled, intriguingly, Our Vision for Liberation. But more than anything else, Professor Papi reminds us of the ethical stakes of doing good historical work. He also exposes, in doing this good work, the consequences of insidious dehumanizing and dehistoricizing work. Professor Papi, needless to say, is not only a friend, not only a colleague, he's also born in Haifa. He served in the Israeli army in 1973, and yet today he's one of the leading critics of colonial Zionism and one of the clearest voices against the inhumane and unethical treatment of the Palestinian people. For that, as I have noted, Ilan has been persecuted, precisely because he disproves the idea that what is happening in Palestine and in Israel is an inherent or age-old religious conflict. He insists, correctly in my view, that what has been happening in Palestine and Israel is a secular conflict, a colonial conflict, where each of us has the ability to affiliate with or against justice, but it's a secular decision. He reminds us that what is at stake today is the question of how we want to envision our future. What kind of future do we want to fight for? And to do that, Ilan has always said, we need to know what kind of past we have gone through to get to the point where we are today. So please join me in welcoming Professor Ilan Papi, who will speak about the crisis of Zionism, opportunities for Palestine. A reminder at the end here, this title came up months ago. So things have changed slightly in the last few weeks, but I'm sure Professor Papi will be able to figure out how to manage this. So please welcome Professor Ilan Papi.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Osama, for your very kind introduction. Thank you all for being here today. I want to thank all the organization that made this event possible. And I really appreciate your taking the time to be with us in this very crucial and painful moment in the history of Israel and Palestine. Before the 7th of October 2023, most of the Israeli Jewish society was looking with some fear and apprehension towards the last weeks of this month. The main discourse in Israel up to the 7th of October 2023 was what would be the future of Israel. Weekly demonstrations by hundreds of thousands of Israelis were part of a movement of protest against the attempt of the government to change the constitutional law in Israel and to create a new political system by which the political powers would have total control over the judicial system and the public domain would be far more controlled by messianic and religious Jewish groups. In one of my articles, I described that particular struggle for the identity of Israel that was the main topic until the 7th of October 2023 as a struggle between the state of Judea and the state of Israel. The state of Judea was the state that was established in the West Bank by Jewish settlers, which was kind of a combination of messianic Judaism, Zionist fanaticism, and racism, and it became a kind of a power structure that became far more prominent and important in the last few years, especially under the Netanyahu government, and was about to impose its way of life, its perception of life, on the rest of Israel, beyond what we call Judea, in a sense, beyond the West Bank or the Jewish space in the West Bank. Against it stood the State of Israel. The State of Israel, if you want, is best epitomized by the city of Tel Aviv. The idea that Israel is pluralistic, democratic, secular, Western, most important than anything else, or European, if you want, and is fighting for its life against the State of Judea. And this was seemed to be the focus on almost, one could call it, the civil war, if not a real civil war, at least a cold civil war, a cultural war for sure, between the Israeli Jews, between themselves. When some people said to both sides of this internal Israeli strife, what about the occupation of the West Bank, for instance? Should this not be part of the discussion of the future of Israel? They were told, no, the occupation should not be mentioned by any side. The occupation is irrelevant to the future of Israel, we were told. In fact, anyone who was trying to bring the occupation as a topic to the protests, the weekly protests, against the legal reform or legal revolution, as they like to call it, was asked to leave and not to appear with the larger group of protesters who were waving the Israeli flag. Definitely, if you brought the Palestinian flag to that demonstration, you would be beaten up and thrown out of the demonstration. If you would mention the fact that maybe the future of Israel is also the conditions and situation of the almost 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel who were going through the last year through a process of criminalization, criminal gangs that terrorized, still are terrorizing the life of Palestinian citizens in Israel, everywhere in Israel, armed gangs, criminal gangs, many of them are former collaborators with Israel in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, who were extracted from these territories after the Oslo Accord, highly, very, very well equipped with weapons and totally immunized from any police persecution, prosecution, I'm sorry, or any kind of effective anti-criminal action, which meant that, as many of you may know, Palestinians who live in Israel itself, I'm talking about the Israeli citizens, are fearful to go out at night because of the new reality in their streets and spaces. So that also was not meant to be a topic for discussion in the public domain on the future of Israel. If you wanted to mention East Jerusalem and the ethnic cleansing of the Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem, again, the demonstrators and their leaders said this is not an important topic. Or as Amir Ahas, the brave journalist of Haaretz, put it, as far as the Israelis were concerned, and this is until the 7th of October 2023, the occupation did not exist, which meant it did not exist as a problem anymore. It is solved. It is solved. There is a PA. There is a very intensive Jewish presence of settlements in the West Bank. No one has to deal with it anymore. In fact, if you look at the last four election campaigns in Israel, and they had quite a few, as you may remember, one after the other, on a yearly basis, nobody mentioned the Palestine issue, Palestine question, the occupation, call it what you will. This was not a topic that Israelis were asked to vote about because it did not exist anymore as a problem. If you mentioned the Gaza Strip, if you were talking about the siege on Gaza, again, people would say, what are you talking about? This is also an issue that doesn't bother anyone anymore. And if you were pointing out to them that actually the daily killing of Palestinians in the last year, what you say in the last 2 years, the daily killing of Palestinians in the West Bank, the constant and recurrent invasion of Al-Aqsa is something that would not will go unnoticed, and there will be repercussions for these policies. And the fact that the feeble Palestinian Authority is unable to protect the Palestinians from the violence of the settlers and the violence of the Israeli army and the violence of the Israeli border police doesn't mean that there are no Palestinian groups that would try and defend the Palestinians, not only in the Gaza Strip, but also those in other parts of historical Palestine. This was said to the Israeli public and policymakers and chief of the Israeli military and secret service again and again. But they said, no, there's no problem. The only problem is the legal reform, whether we accept it or not accept it. And it was very clear why all these other issues were not dealt with. Because what we had in essence in Israel is a struggle between two forms of apartheid. There was the secular Israeli apartheid, in which Israeli Jews definitely enjoy life in a democracy, in a pluralist democracy, if you want, a Western-style democracy. That's the kind of apartheid that they wanted to sustain. And you had the counter version of apartheid, the messianic one, the religious one, the theocratic one. So the fight was a domestic Jewish issue of what kind of Jewish life would be in the public domain without any reference to the life of Palestinians, whether these were Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank, under a siege in the Gaza Strip, or under a discriminatory system inside Israel, and not to mention the many millions of Palestinian refugees. All of this was not there. And it all blew up in the face of the Israelis in the morning of the 7th of October. And there is an optical illusion now that because of the shock that definitely Israel underwent in the morning of Saturday, the 7th of October, that all these cracks in the edifice, in the Zionist edifice, has disappeared. Because the Hamas attack was so brutal, so devastating, that all the internal debates have been forgotten, and everybody is united behind the army and its present plan for invading the Gaza Strip and commencing with the already have commenced the genocidal policies on the ground. I think it's an optical illusion. I think the Israeli internal strife is not going away. It will return. I don't know when, but it will return. But what is more important, and this is something we should insist on, I think, as activists, as academics, anyone who in one way or another is related to Palestine and the Palestinian struggle, is our insistence that the events of the 7th of October, however we understand them, however we approach them, from a humane point of view, from a strategic point of view, from a moral point of view, however we approach them, we should not fall into the trap that is seems to quite a lot of good people even are falling into in this country, into decontextualizing and dehistoricizing the events of the 7th of October. And this is something that will not change in the coming weeks. The basic reality on the ground is still the same reality on the ground that was there before the 7th of October. The Palestinian people, since probably 1929, are involved in a struggle for liberation. It's an anti-colonialist struggle. It's an anti-settler anti-colonialist struggle. And every anti-colonialist struggle has its ups and lows. Every anti-colonialist struggle has moments of glory and has difficult moments of violence. Decolonization is not a pharmaceutical process. It's not a sterile process. It's a messy business. And the longer the colonialism and the oppression, the more likely that the outburst would be violent and desperate in many, many ways. And this is so important to remind people of the history of the rebellions of slaves in this country and how they ended, the revolts of Native Americans, the rebellions of Algerians against the settlers in Algeria, the massacre of Oran during the fight of the FLN for liberation. This is something which is part of the struggle for liberation. You can sometimes question some of the strategic ideas. You may have some uneasy moments, and rightly so, about the way things are being done. But you can never lose your moral compass if you don't decontextualize and dehistoricize the event itself. You seem to be in a struggle against a typical coverage, both by media and academia in this country and in the West in general and in the global North in general, that has this ability to take an event and start with the event as if it has no history. It have no consequence. I mean, even the stories about the kind of party or festival that was attacked on the 7th of November does not mention the fact that this was a festival of love and peace, kilometer and a half from the ghetto of Gaza. People were celebrating love and peace while the people of Gaza, 2 kilometers from that fence, were under one of the most brutal siege in human history that was going on for more than 15 years, controlled by the Israelis, deciding how many calories are getting into the Gaza Strip, deciding who goes in, who goes out, and keeping 2 million people in the biggest prison, open prison on earth. All these contexts allow you to navigate, I think, morally without losing that compass. But far more important than the immediate context, and even the context of the siege, and this is what I would like to focus tonight, is the fact that one of the biggest challenge as activists for Palestine or scholars on Palestine who are activists is that we cannot challenge decades of propaganda and fabrication and counter-narrative with sound bites. This is our main problem, I think. We need space. We need time to explain the reality, because so many outlets, so many sources of information, so many places where knowledge is produced has portrayed a picture, an analysis of Palestine, which is false, fabricated, and has been built throughout the years with the help of academia, the media, Hollywood, TV series, and so on. I mean, these are media that works on people's minds and emotions, and they created a certain story that you cannot challenge with one soundbite. You cannot even challenge it alone by your sense of justice. You can only challenge it if your sense of justice is based on profound knowledge of the history, a profound and accurate analysis of the reality by using the right language, because the language that is being used even by liberal so-called progressive forces is a language that immunizes Israel and does not allow the Palestinian anti-colonial struggle to be justified, to be accepted and legitimized, and you know, in the pantheon of anti-colonialist struggle, which many people would put a lot of heroes from Nelson Mandela to Gandhi and to other important leaders of anti-liberation movement, you will not find one Palestinian. They will always be treated as terrorists, whereas by essence they were an anti-colonialist movement. And that kind of insistence of using the right language, of knowing the history of the place, and having the right analysis is something, as I said, you need space for doing it. You can't sort of come and say you're wrong and I'm right. And this is a huge challenge for all of us, I think, in a moment like these days in America, for instance, where there seems to be this unconditional support for Israel and hypocritical approach to the suffering of Israelis that was never displayed towards the suffering of Palestinians in any given moment in the history of Palestine. The history lessons, so to speak, that is the antidote to dehistoricizing the events of the 7th of October and the events that are unfolding in front of our eyes today and probably in the next few weeks, if not months. The historical context has, I think, two levels, two basic pillars on which they should stand, and I think are very important for anyone who is involved in public debates on an individual basis or an institutional basis, on an academic domain or the media domain. It doesn't matter. The same kind of pillars are relevant to all these kinds of struggles. One is never to let go from our insistence of an accurate definition of Zionism. This is so important. You should not allow any discussion of what goes on in Israel today or in Palestine today without talking about Zionism. And this is why, and it's not a coincidence, so much effort has been invested by Israel and its supporters in this country and in other countries to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, that if you ever mention the word Zionism, you're already in the dangerous domain of being regarded as an anti-Semite, and therefore you will be ably be silenced. But that doesn't mean that this is not the only and right way to start the story. The story starts with an ideology which is racist. At its very heart, it's a racist ideology. It belongs to the genealogy of racism, not to the history of liberation movements, which is how it is taught in most American universities, not to the history of national movements, as it being taught in most of the global north, or is talked about or covered by the Western media. No, it belongs to the history of racism, an ideology not in its very origin, but in the way it manifested itself on the land of Palestine. And this racism is part of the settler colonial nature of the Zionist movement, namely a movement which is not exceptional, which you are familiar with in this country as well, of Europeans who were chucked out of Europe and had to find a different place to be Europeans in it because they were not accepted as Europeans, and they found countries in which other people lived. And as the late Patrick Wolf said in that encounter, the logic of the elimination of the native was activated the moment these settlers met the indigenous people. And that is true about Palestine as well. Eliminatory policies were the DNA of Zionist encounter with the Palestinians from the very inception of the Zionist movement in the late 19th century. To put it in less academic words, you wanted as much of Palestine as possible with as few Palestinians as possible. There was always the demographic dimension and the geographical dimension, the population dimension and the space dimension. The more space you have, the less you want the indigenous population in it. Eliminatory policies could be genocide, could be ethnic cleansing, apartheid. They take different forms in different places, and they take different forms in the same place according to capacity, historical circumstances, and condition. But you cannot take out what happened in Gaza from these Israeli, and before that Zionist, eliminatory policies, from the elimination of the native. An elimination of the native that began first in Zionist thought, in the drawing of Zionist painters, in the writing of Zionist thinkers, and became a strategy in the 1930s that was first implemented in 1948 in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that ended with the expulsion of half of the Palestinians and the destruction of half of Palestine's villages. By the way, many of these villages are on the ruins of these villages. Some of the kibbutzim that were occupied by the Hamas for a few hours were built. These kibbutzim were built on the ruins of these Palestinian villages from 1948, and quite a few of the Palestinians who went into this kibbutzim were a third generation of Palestinian refugees from these very destroyed villages not far from Gaza. This is also part of the story. Not everything that I'm saying here means that I'm justify everything that was done. No, I don't. But it means that it gives you an historical context without which you are not getting to the source of violence, and you're only dealing with the symptoms of the violence. And you need to go to the source of the violence. And the source of the violence is a certain ideology, a certain racist ideology, a Zionist ideology, that at its very basic is the idea of the elimination of the native. As I say, this is not entirely unique for Zionism. There were other European settler colonial movement who definitely were motivated and inspired by the idea of the elimination of the native. So if you look in a very cursory way on that history, you understand that what is really important for an ideological movement that is motivated by the idea of having as much of the new land as possible with as few of its native people as possible, you understand that what is really important is the historical period in which it was conceived and the historical period in which it enacted its policies of elimination. Now, if you enact these policies of elimination in the 19th century, as had been done in the United States, you're talking about a world that is quite indifferent to colonialism, to racism, and other human rights, collective human rights, or civil rights. But if you say to yourself, wait a minute, this has been done after the Second World War. It was actually done in the year of the Declaration of Human Rights that the Global North was so proud of, as saying to the world after the Second World War, we now have moral foundation that would make sure that the massive killing of people, as we've seen in the Second World War, that racism that we have seen in so many places would be eradicated because there is a moral consensus. When you think in the same year, South Africa issued the apartheid law and Israel exercised the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, you begin to understand the message that both the apartheid regime in South Africa received and, more importantly, the Zionist state received in 1948 from the international community. Yes, we are proudly announcing the Declaration of Human Rights, but we are also telling you it does not apply to you. It does not apply to you. The message from the world was that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine is acceptable, mainly for the reason, I mean, this was the propaganda. I don't think it was the real reason. But it was the kind of saying, in the words of one American intellectual, it was tolerating a small injustice to correct a much bigger injustice. Namely, Palestinians had to compensate the Jews for 1,000 years of European and Christian anti-Semitism. And the deal was very clear, and this is why Israel was the first state to recognize a new Germany. People in Europe and in the West were very hesitant whether to accept West Germany as a member of the civilized nations so few years after the Nazi regime. But the moment they got a green light from Israel that pretended, and not rightly so, to represent both the survivors of the Holocaust and the victims of the Holocaust as the ultimate representative of the Holocaust, they said, we will declare a new Germany, and in return, we want non-interference from the West in what we are doing in Palestine. You would have expected Israel at least to be the third country that recognizes a new Germany, not the first one. But it was very important for them to have this deal. Also, it also meant that the new Germany provided Israel with a huge financial assistance that helped to build the modern Israeli army already in the early 1950s. Now, when the message from the world was that ethnic cleansing is, in the case of the state of Israel, an acceptable method of national security strategy, it's not surprising that the ethnic cleansing continued. Israel expelled 36 villages between 1948 and 1967 inside Israel. Israel expelled 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip during the June 67 war. Israel expelled from 1967 until today almost 700,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And as we are talking, Israel is continuing the ethnic cleansing in places such as Masafir Yatta, the South Hebron Mountains, the Greater Jerusalem area, and other parts of Palestine. Ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian became the DNA of Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, and it employs hundreds of thousands of people to exercise it, because these are not massive ethnic cleansings like in 1948. These are incremental ethnic cleansing. Sometimes it's the expulsion of one person, of one family. Sometimes it's not even an expulsion. Sometimes it's a closure of a village or enclaving the Gaza Strip. It's also a form of ethnic cleansing, because if you create the Gaza ghetto, you don't have demographically to calculate these 2 million Palestinians in the demographic balance between Arabs and Jews, because these Palestinians have no say in the future of historical Palestine. This is the one historical pillar that is necessary for anyone telling us or using this vile language that people are now using against the Palestinians, when people tell us that if we wave the Palestinian flag, we are supporting terrorism. If people compare what happened on the 7th of October in the morning to the Holocaust, and by that totally abusing the Holocaust memory, either they don't understand or they don't know what they're doing. But even if they go with it and take the high moral ground, it's so important to locate this particular event into the wider, distant history of modern Palestine and the particular history of the siege on Gaza that began in 2007, the inhuman siege of 2 million people in one of the longest, probably the longest siege ever on such a large number of people in terms of food, water, freedom of movement, and other basic necessities of life, that led already the United Nations in 2020 to think that life in the Gaza Strip is unsustainable for human beings. Already 3 years ago, they thought we already crossed the red line in Gaza. So don't be surprised if when people go out of there, there is outrage, there is revenge, there is violence. Of course there is. There was, same happened with the rebellions of slaves, of indigenous Native Americans, of colonized people from India through North Africa. Anti-colonialist struggle, as I said before, is not a work of Quakers and pacifists. It's can be very violent and can be very peaceful, and much of it depends on how much the colonizer the ethnic cleanser is willing to take in the fact that the people who are, that they are colonized or oppressed are not going to disappear and are not going to give up their struggle. The sooner you understand it, the more likely you will have a much peaceful transformation from a colonialist reality to post-colonialist reality. If you refuse to understand it, it will hit you in the face again and again, and the 7th of October is not the last moment of such an event. But there is also another historical context that I would like to bring to your attention. And this is so important because in all this discourse that accompanied the coverage in the media and by politicians in this country and in the West in general, it was very easy to see how people slip over to generalization about the Palestinians, kind of having these adjectives about the Palestinians, a general characteristic of Palestinians. We heard it before after 9/11 about Muslims in general. We heard it during the colonialist period against any people who dared to challenge the empires. There's nothing new in it. But it is important to remind people that Zionism was a disaster that destroyed a Palestine that would have been different without Zionism. This is so important to remind people how Palestine was before 1948. Palestine, where Muslim, Christians, and Jews coexisted, when coexistence was not a fabricated idea of live and let live, but was a genuine way of living together. One should not idealize it. Of course, it had its tension. It has its moment of crisis. But it was a mosaic of life that, particularly in Palestine, was enabled people to also enjoy what the land had to offer. And the land had to offer something you won't find today in Palestine. The land offered an affluence of water, for instance. Only people who remember Palestine before 48 know that every Palestinian village had a stream of fresh water. This Zionist fable that the president of the EU just recently repeated by saying that Zionism bloomed the desert. It's such a fabrication of history. Zionism turned a blooming country into a desert in many places. That is something but you could only do it if you reconstruct with the help of historians the kind of Palestine that was there before 1948, both in terms of humanity and human relationship, and also in ecological terms. The whole connection between Palestinian and herbs, for instance, and nature that Zionism destroyed was part of the quality of life that Palestinians had. Or as the late Emil Habibi put it, when he lived in Abbas Street in Haifa, he said, "I never knew who was a Christian or a Muslim in my street before 1948. And I think this is something that is not nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia. This is an alternative history, if you want, in the sense of telling you that there was a possibility for a different Palestine. And to that history, we should also include the fact that the Palestinian national movement, the Palestinian anti-colonialist national movement, from the moment Zionism set foot in Palestine, in historical Palestine, was loyal to two principles. And this is so well documented that you don't have to work very hard to find it. There were two principles that the Palestinians were loyal to. And particularly, they said it to the Americans because the Americans brought this principle through President Woodrow Wilson to the Arab world, especially to the Mashrek, the Eastern Mediterranean, in 1919. And then the United Nations brought it, kind of repeated these principles. One principle was the right of self-determination for people. The Palestinians said, we also deserve right for self-determination, like the Iraqis, like the Lebanese, like the Egyptians. The second principle was democracy. You know, if you are taking us out of Ottoman rule, under which we were for 400 years. And you want us to decide our post-Ottoman future. What will be our future? What will be the nature of our regime, of our state, of our political existence? We want democratically, by the vote of majority, to decide whether we want to be part of Greater Syria, whether we want to be an independent Arab Palestine, maybe we want to be in a federated Arab, pan-Arab republic, but it's up to us. And every American delegation that went from 1918 until 1948, every international delegation, whether it was Anglo-American, whether it was any other organization, the reply to the Palestinians was that while the principle of democracy and self-determination is cherished by the Western world and they see it as the right pillars on which to build the new post-Ottoman Arab world, it cannot apply to Palestine. Because Palestine was promised by the British Empire to become a Jewish state, and because the Jews are such a tiny minority, the principle of self-determination cannot be applied to the Palestinians, and of course the principle of majority or democratic election is out of the question for the Palestinians. This is also important in the context of our historical journey into the past in order to contextualize the kind of oppression, the kind of history or genealogy of racism that was endorsed and supported by the West when it came to Palestine. Now, this other pillar is not just important in order to remind us what Zionism did or what Palestine could have been. This is the foundation on which we will build a post-liberated Palestine, a post-colonial Palestine. This is the foundation. And think about the elements of this past and how they relate to a different reality from the one we had. And don't let the current attack on Gaza Strip, the genocidal policies by Israel, let you shy away from continuing to think about the liberation of Palestine and how the liberated Palestine would look like. And talk to the Palestinians who are thinking about, not just about the tactical move tomorrow, but who are visualizing. That's what I did with my book with Ramzi Baroud. How we talked to 40 Palestinian thinkers and asked them, how do you visualize a liberated Palestine? And if you look at the way that the vision, their vision for liberation, and the vision of liberation, not just how to struggle for liberation, but what will the liberation bring with it? It's all the elements you had in Palestine before 1948. A society that does not discriminate on the basis of religion or sect or cultural identity. A society that respects democracy. A society that respects the principles on live and let live. And more importantly, maybe than anything else, a society that brings back Palestine into the Arab world, into the Muslim world, organically into the place from which it was extracted by force. Now, being part of the Arab world is not an easy scenario for many people, and rightly so. But you cannot be a part of the solution or the more positive scenarios for the Arab world if you're not part of the problems of the Arab world. You cannot have a discussion of human rights in Iran or civil rights in Egypt if you don't include the civil rights and human rights of the Palestinians. There is no point for these discussions because you will always get to the exceptionalism of the Palestinian lack of these rights, and you will always find yourself in an inferior position if you want from the outside to help the Arab world to deal with these issues of human rights and civil rights. And it's only when Palestine, the future Palestine, would be part of the Arab world that it would be part of its problems, but it would be also part of its solution. I will end by saying, just to repeat the main point which I really want to make tonight. there is always an illusion with a dramatic, and it, one cannot underestimate the drama that we are seeing, the human catastrophe. And we are just, unfortunately, I think that we're only seeing the beginning of the human catastrophe that Israel is going to impose, not only on the Gaza Strip, unfortunately, also on the West Bank. They're going to use this as a pretext to change their policies in the West Bank as well. Of course, the most urgent thing is to try and stop it by all the means that are at our disposal in this country to put pressure for an international intervention that put a stop to these genocidal policies that, as I say, I'm very afraid would be extended to the West Bank as well. But part of what we always have to do as well is to strategize for the future, because the basic issues will be here also after this particular moment in time would end in one way or another. And it is this kind of discussion that would ensure, to my mind, that we're not losing our moral compass. We are not deterred by the way people are trying to say to us, surely after what happened on the 7th of October, you cannot keep your old positions on morality. And we should remind people that nobody questioned the right of Algeria to be free, the right of Kenya to be free, the right of India to be free from colonialism, despite any incidents that were there in the struggle for liberation, or whatever level of violence there was there, or whatever kind, whatever form the clash between the anti-colonialist forces took place with the colonialist forces. We never question the basic right for liberation and independence, and neither should we do this in the case of Palestine. If you want to see a peaceful Palestine, you have to talk first and foremost about a free Palestine. Thank you.
That was Professor Ian Popp, an Israeli historian who now teaches at the University of Exeter in London. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN LP, now broadcasting at 91.9 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. سكروها بوجه الناس وما عاد حدا يقدر يشوفها بعيون الناس حرقوها هدموها واحتلوا البيوت بعز شوية أحجار وياسمين تعربش على الحيطان القدس بيوت وشوارع حارة. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.